Good morning, everybody. I'd like to welcome you all here today to the Women in Public Sector Leadership Lecture. Also, a big hello to those of us joining us from Saskatoon. We look forward to hearing more from you in the question and answer session later. My name is Rebecca Gibbons. I'm a graduate student in the Masters of Public Administration program here at Johnson Tshoyama. Currently, I work in Cabinet Planning and Executive Council. I'm also a former employee of the university, so I've had the opportunity and the pleasure of being able to work alongside today's moderator, President Vianne Timmins, and panelists Claire Eisman, Louise Greenberg, and Alana Cook. I'm just going to go over some details of today's event before introducing the panel in depth, and then turning it over to the capable hands of President Timmins, who will be moderating this discussion. This event will be live streamed and a recording can be found at www.schoolofpublicpolicy.ca. Following the presentations, we will open up the floor for questions and answers, which will be moderated by President Timmins. For those attending in Regina, if you want to write your questions on one of the cards that were handed out to you when you came in the door, hold it up and it will be picked up by Karen or Janice at the back. For those of us joining by live stream or in Saskatoon, please tweet your questions to the handle at JSGSPP. If you are in Saskatoon and without access to Twitter, please see Erica Schindel, who will be able to post them on your behalf. For those of you not familiar with the Johnson Tshoyama Graduate School of Public Policy, it was established in June 2007 and named after two of Saskatchewan's best-known public servants, Albert W. Johnson and Thomas K. Tshoyama, both of whom began their careers here in Saskatchewan and served as deputy ministers in Ottawa. The Johnson Tshoyama Graduate School of Public Policy is a provincial centre for advanced study and research in public policy and administration. Located on two university campuses, the University of Regina and the University of Saskatchewan, the school is a source of respected policy advice and commentary. With a diversity of academic backgrounds in political science, economics, sociology, geography, law, and health policy, the school's faculty members engage with and mentor graduate students in an interdisciplinary environment, educate the public on policy matters, and enrich the knowledge base from which policymakers draw. It is in the spirit of inquiry and public service that Johnson Tshoyama hosts this public lecture on women in public sector leadership. Good leadership is hard to define, and good leadership even harder. If I was to ask each of you in the room today to define good leadership, a lot of you would be hard-pressed to come up with an answer, if only for the reason that most of us have experienced bad leadership. If I were to ask what good leadership means to you, that is a different story. When I was asked by Kathy to introduce today's speakers, I did what any lazy student with not much time on their hands did, and I Googled some questions for quotes on women in leadership. There was a lot out there. There was a lot related to research, paying attention, leading with your gut, being authentic, leaning in, all quotes from well-established leaders. But I wasn't as interested in their sound bites as I was in their stories, and what I learned was the climb can be tough going for anyone. But as women, there are particular hurdles that can make the journey upward towards positions of power and influence especially challenging. Senior public servants are accountable to the public and must remain neutral in a complex and political environment while providing evidence-based decisions and thoughtful advice. At the same time, as leaders, they can't just focus on the operations, strategies, and tactics of their work. They have a duty to try and find time to shape the future. What I know from my limited research is that I have more questions than answers, which is where everybody here comes in. Is leadership an art or a science? You could probably argue that it's a craft, but how do you do that, knowing that you've a long way to go, and that most important step, where do you begin? Of the 18 Government of Saskatchewan ministries, six are led by female deputy ministers. I'd like to introduce you to three of them, hand you over to the very capable President Timmins, in the hopes that they can provide some answers to these questions. Claire Eisman is the Deputy Minister of Finance. Prior to her appointment in this position in 2012, she was the Deputy Minister of Advanced Education, Employment and Immigration, and served as Chair of the Public Service Commission from 2004 to 2009. She's a Bachelor of Commerce degree from the University of Saskatchewan and an FCPA-FCMA designation. She was also recently awarded a fellowship from CMA Canada and a public service award. Her extensive experience also includes a 17-year stint with the City of Regina before joining the Government of Saskatchewan in 1998. Louise Greenberg has been Deputy Minister of Advanced Education since May 2012. Prior to her appointment, she was the Associate Deputy Minister in the Ministry of Social Services and responsible for Child and Family Services. Louise holds a PhD from the University of Saskatchewan, as well as a BSc and an MSc from McGill University. Louise has 30 years of service with the Government of Saskatchewan. She has served as an ADM with the Ministries of Health, Deputy Minister of the Regional Economic and Cooperative Development, and Assistant Deputy Minister with the Ministry of Agriculture. She also has a history with Johnson Tshoyama, having served as a Saskatchewan Senior Fellow with the school here in 2001. Alana Cook was appointed Deputy Minister of Saskatchewan Agriculture in November 2007. She's been involved in the agricultural industry, both professionally and personally, for most of her life. Her background includes roles of director with AgriCorps United, executive director with the Western Canadian Wheat Growers Association, and vice president and then president of the Canadian Agri-Food Trade Alliance for 2 years prior to her appointment as deputy minister. Alana currently serves on the boards of Saskatchewan Crop Insurance Corporation and Saskatchewan Trade and Export Partnership and the Global Institute for Food Security, a unique public-private partnership aimed at increasing the supply and quality of food to help solve food security issues around the world while advancing the growth of Western Canada's bioeconomy. In 2005, her contributions to the agriculture industry and her community were recognized when she received the Saskatchewan Centennial Medal. She was named one of Saskatchewan Agricultural Hall of Fame in 2011 inductees, and in 2012 she received the Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Medal for her work on behalf of the province's producer. Lastly, Dr. Vianne Timmins. Dr. Timmins is President and Vice Chancellor of the University of Regina. Since becoming President in 2008, she has played an active role in shaping the strategic direction of the university with a strong focus on community relationships, Aboriginal education, and internationalization. Named one of Canada's most powerful women, not just in 2008, but 2009, 2010, and 2011, Dr. Timmins is nationally and internationally recognized expert in inclusive education and family literacy research. She's active in the academic community at the regional, national, and international levels. She's currently president of the International Association for the Scientific Study of Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. In recent years, she's also served as vice president, Canadian region, for the Inter-American Organization for Higher Education, as well as chair of the Canadian Bureau for International Education. I would ask you all to welcome today's panel and moderator, and we look forward to hearing their questions.
Thank you, Rebecca. It's great to see you again. Rebecca is one of our graduates, graduate English, and also finishing, as you mentioned earlier, MPA, and as mentioned, a former employee. So I like when you hang on to the University of Regina. Welcome, Saskatoon. It's so great that you're here. You know, this is a topic I'm passionate about, women in leadership. And when I look out at the audience and that we wanted 100 people and we quickly got those numbers, it tells me you're hungry for this topic also, and passionate. It's really, really important in 2015 to keep this conversation going. And there's a need to still change perceptions about women in leadership roles, and I can give you all the stats, including in university presidents. You know, 19 out of 94 are women, and in 1994, there were 19 women presidents. So we haven't changed those numbers at all. I'm just going to give you a short, just a quick little story. My daughter is 22, doing her master's in marine management at a university in Canada, and she's reserved, just like her mother, and a little quiet, just like her mother. But she was taking the program. She wasn't enjoying it at all, and she got the midterm marks back, and she did extremely well. One of her professors said to her, "You're so understated." He said, "I was so surprised to see someone who was pretty had a brain." This is in 2015. Those comments still happen. They still go on. If they're not said, they're thought. And we need women in leadership that talk about the issues that are faced by women, and in particular faced by our young women, and to make sure that we deal. The other story I'll tell is 2009. I was in Idaho at a PENWAR conference, and Bob McDonald, who's the head of the Engineering Association for Saskatchewan, was there, and I was at a table of all men. And the governor came over, and he decided, I was a new president, he said, "Oh, President Timmins, I want to introduce you to the governor." And he waved the governor over, and he said, "Governor, I want to introduce you to the president of University of Regina." Some of you may have heard me tell this story before, have you? Some of you? So he leaned passed me to the man beside me and said, so pleased to meet you. And then Bob said, no, that's not President Timmons. And before he could correct, the governor leaned to the next man and said, so pleased to meet you, President Timmons. And Bob said, no, it's her. And he stepped back and he said, but you're a woman. Just like that. And then he goes, oh, my God, I can't believe that came out of my mouth. And I said, yes, I am a woman. And then he laughed and made a joke of it and went on. But it tells you still today what we face, if not said, thought. And it's really important to do that. And today we have a great panel to discuss women in leadership. I've worked with both Louise and Claire, and so great to have you. And Alana, as I mentioned, I've heard so much about you. I was in the lineup earlier while we were waiting to get going, and one of the women said to me, I'm looking forward to being wowed by Anne. And I said, well, that's good, because I'm the choreographer. These are the dancers. They are going to wow you today, and not me. So I'm looking forward to your insights, to your perspectives, and to your advice. I think that's critically important. So let's get started. I'm going to start, as was mentioned by Rebecca, with four or five questions to prompt discussion, about 40 minutes, and then we will open it up to you. So I'll begin with Louise, who's the closest to me, but I'm going to ask all three of you the same questions. And I might even ad lib. I know you've got a script, but if you prompt something that makes me curious, I'm going to ask you more questions. So I know you're scripted, but be prepared, all right? We're going to keep this interesting. So name one skill you have as a leader, and if you one skill that has served you well, what is that?
The one skill that I'll explain or talk about is probably relationships. In the job that I have and in the previous jobs that I've had, putting time and effort into maintaining relationships and building relationships with the people I work with, that I communicate with, that I spend time with, has probably been one of my assets. As part of my current role, and even in previous roles, I have to build trust, I have to build communication networks, and I have to spend a lot of time on relationships with stakeholders. And then I have to be able to build relationships with people in the ministry, because I have to communicate and provide direction and give some guidance and also be able to provide a vision. And I think all that requires communication, and which is based on a bit of relationship. So I'll leave it at that, because I don't want to hog the time.
Claire, one skill that right. served you well.
Well, thank you. Hi, everybody. So first of all, the question, actually, the way I received it was, what's your greatest skill? And I thought, well, gee, I'm not going to talk about what my greatest skill is, because that's the fact that I'm old and I've got a lot of experience. So I'll put that on the table first and foremost. So I like your question better. So I think for me, when I thought about it, it was probably being thoughtful, acknowledging that I don't know everything. So you've got to seek to learn and to understand, which ultimately means putting a lot of trust and faith into the people that you work with and the team around you. Because as a leader, you tend to work really broadly and not very deep on any one subject matter. So I think having faith and trust in all of those people around you to enable you to then do what you need to do as a leader really does support, I think, ultimately being successful. That's where I'd go.
Thank you. Alana.
Well, I guess when I saw this question, it's always hard to sort of say what's the one skill, but I think when I thought about what has served me best and the leaders that I think have been the ones to follow, it's about being values-based. Some people say walk the talk. I guess pick whatever word works for you, but, in my opinion, it's being values-based. So being very genuine and authentic in who you are, and making sure that you stand by your decisions and you stand by your employees' decisions, that if you make a mistake, you kind of admit the mistake, you don't worry about it too much, but you obviously learn from it. You clean up quickly and you move on. You know, I think that that's important for us in building our teams and employees as well. If we want people to be innovative and risk takers, we need to make sure that we're, you know, take that values-based approach and treat them well, even if mistakes are made. And there's also vulnerability in a leader in kind of admitting to mistakes. And I think sometimes leaders think that they can't be vulnerable because it means it's weakness. And I guess I would view it a different way. I think it's about being strong and being transparent and kind of admitting when you've when you maybe don't have it all figured out. So I think that's really important, and I see that really about being values-based. And then I guess also communication and being as open and honest as you can be with people also to me is about being values-based. So obviously in leadership positions, sometimes you can't share everything, but share what you can as openly as you can, and then admit that some things can't be shared and explain why, give context to that. And I think that brings people a long way to understanding, you know, where they sit in the organization or, you know, the direction they've been giving, and given that they understand the context of it better, as opposed to, you know, sort of that sometimes position of power, well, I know something you don't know, and look at how smart I am, and look at how important I am. And I think that sometimes really doesn't lead to a healthy organization. So, you know, for me, I guess the other thing is I would never ask anybody to do something that I wouldn't be willing to do myself. So whether that's hard work or figuring something out or doing something, you know, selling some tough news, I would be the first one in, and I guess I would view that about being values-based as well. So make sure you treat others the way you want to be treated. Make sure that you're the first one through the door on the tough stuff and the last one through the door on the celebration. I mean, I think that's all about being values-based. So I don't know if that's one skill, but that's the one approach that's worked for me.
So now I'm going to ad-lib. So you don't have this prepared, but you've got to open the door for me. All of you have shown humility in the skill you've identified, and relationships, in trusting your team and sharing, allowing your team to do the job, and in value-based. I heard this about me, and so I'm going to ask you, do you ever get challenged about you can't be tough? You're not going to make the tough decisions because you're too concerned about relationships. You're not going to make the tough decisions because you're too concerned about your staff. Or you're not going to make the tough decisions because you're so value-based in your leadership. So tell me, as a woman, and I'll get you to begin, Alana, how do you balance that with those tough decisions? You mentioned that you're first out with the tough decisions. But that's a gendered comment often made about women, is that if you're warm and you're caring and you're concerned about others, then you can't be tough. Mm-hmm. So tell me how you balance that.
Well, I mean, I guess it is about balance, but just because you are empathetic and understanding and intuitive and values-based and vulnerable doesn't mean that you're weak and can't deliver the tough news. In fact, I think in some cases you can deliver tough news more easily because you're basing it on an organization that's healthy and believes that as a leader you've got, you know, their best interests in mind, and you've been honest and straightforward with everything you're doing. So if anything, you can deliver tough news almost I'm not going to say an easier way, but in a way that has context around it. And I don't think it means that we can't deliver tough news. You're right. Sometimes maybe women are viewed, you know, as softer because of our approach, but I don't think in reality that's been proven out by, you know, any performance statistics of organizations led by women. In fact, I think, you know, leaders who demonstrate values-based approach or demonstrate this vulnerability or authenticity, in fact, demonstrate from an outcomes or results base, then in fact they're more effective. So, and I don't think that's about men or women, because I think men can also be values-based. In fact, that's where a lot of my skills I've learned from really great leaders I've worked with, majority of them having been men. I've also learned from some really awful leaders what not to do and how I don't want to treat people, because I didn't want to be treated that way either. So I guess it's about having that right trust and kind of values-based approach, and it allows you to make the tough decisions, deliver the tough news, because you've got a healthier organization to work with to deliver on the tough stuff.
Claire?
Yeah, it's a good question, Vianne. I think for me, they aren't mutually exclusive at all. In fact, after 11 years of being a deputy minister and, you know, being a supervisor and manager for lots of years before that, It's all about tough decisions. And what I find always so interesting is the fact that people think that making decisions about being values-based and leading an organization is in some way not tough. That's the tough work for me. You know, balancing the books and doing the technical stuff, that's not, you know, they say that that's the hard skills and that this other stuff is the soft. I actually think they're completely reversed. And I think that's what leads to good leadership, is understanding and appreciating that that in and of itself is making tough decisions and tough choices. Leading people is hard work, and there's nothing particularly easy about it. And I don't think it's about tough. I think it's about being prepared, knowing your material. I think Alana talked about, you know, working hard and being the first one in and not afraid to do anything. That's how you learn. That's the basic foundation of what you do. And then I think it's about being confident. And that's not about being tough. That's just about being well prepared, know your material, and then be confident in delivering whatever it is that you're doing. So as I say, I think the notion that women aren't tough, no one would ever describe me as not being tough, particularly my husband. But you don't have to come across as being nasty or mean-spirited or anything to be tough and strong. I think those are just synonyms that maybe don't work for me in today's world.
Louise, well, I thought a little bit about the word tough, and I agree with what Alana and Claire said. So, you know, you think about tough, what does it mean? You know, does it mean saying no, stop, or, you know, go, you know, go somewhere, I can say, you know, go F off. You know, what does it really mean? Tough. So, you know, what does it mean? Because, you know, tough is really, you know, putting the boots to somebody. I mean, when you think about it, what we've all achieved, and yourselves and everyone sitting up here, we've gotten to where we are because we're tough. It takes resilience, it takes backbone, it takes hard work, it takes the being able to do a lot of different things, take opportunities when you may not think there's an opportunity. That's being tough. So I think, you know, just because you can yell and scream or put somebody in their place, that's actually not being tough. So I think being tough is being a survivor. And so, you know, when I was young, I was when I was doing a master's, it was tough. The work was tough. I was setting up a lab. So, and I had to get used to, I had a supervisor who demanded a lot. So he said to me, you know, I have expectations. So I said, well, Greenbergs, don't quit. I'm in for the long run. And that is being tough. You know, you don't give up. So that's how I would approach that.
So are there gender-based differences that are relevant to leadership? And I'll get Claire, you to begin with that one then. Because tough is often contributed to male style of leadership.
Yeah.
Are there gender-based differences? And you've disputed that now for everybody, so.
You know, I think for me, well, maybe I'm a little bit of a hopeful person. I think it's changed over the last 30 years. So I would say, you know, based on the early days of my career when I finished business school and I was working in the accounting profession that was predominantly male-dominated and thinking about, you know, wanting to be a supervisor and a leader at that point in time, I think maybe there was some differences. But I actually do think it's changed, and I think it comes back to something that has already been said. And I think part of it's, we talk more about leadership and leadership style today than we did 30 years ago. And it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. I think we are having better conversations about what that means, and the expectation on organizations to be successful is based on all of us being good leaders. And I think the expectation, no matter where you are, whether you're a man or a woman, is to be a good leader first and foremost. And maybe that's the nice part of this transformation, I think, that's going on, is the willingness to have the conversation. A lot more conversation about what it takes to be a successful leader. Discussion about self-awareness, and I think, you know, if I think back to the men that I worked with 30 years ago, and you talked about being self-aware and thinking about, you know, what were the personality styles that you had and what does it take to make a team, those conversations wouldn't have happened around a management table that was diverse with men and women sitting around it. It was awkward. People didn't know how to deal with it. In my early days, I worked a lot in the field of employment equity. and gender differences. And I remember having conversations with, you know, significant groups of men that, you know, when you talk to them about those kinds of things, it just made the hair on their neck stand up. Like, it was so uncomfortable for them. The good news is today I have this conversation with my colleagues all the time. And, you know, for some of them it's uncomfortable, but I'd say for the vast majority it's not. And the flip side of that is, you know what, for some women it's uncomfortable still too. And so, you know, I think, you know, when I think about it overall, we're just getting to a different place of that level of self-awareness and knowing that we have to develop skills in order to be good leaders, that you aren't born with it. It's not an innate trait, and it just takes work and effort.
So are there gender-based differences that are relevant to leadership? Your answer is no or yes?
I'd say no. I think the background, it has way more to do about other things other than gender that drive what those differences are, and I think that has more to do with background, skill level, self-awareness, willingness to do different things, and I don't think that that is gender-based. I think that's just human-based.
Louise?
I don't think there's really, you know, where the differences really come in, I call it the estrogen testosterone discussion, and I've got a science background, so I always like to revert to the science part of how the world works. So there are some differences on, if you think just from an estrogen testosterone point of view, the way people look at things, the way they might approach it. I mean, if you think about young men and women now in their 20s and 30s who are entering the workforce, their mothers, their dads would have been exposed to way different things. Their role models would have been different to what's going on now. So like Claire, I agree, it's slowly changing. You know, some of the gender-based differences, it's changed over time. I think I've worked mainly in male-dominated fields because I sort of grew up while working in the area of agriculture for many years. And you could see some of the differences when some of the people you worked with, some of these guys have, you know, started having kids and were having daughters. Well, you know, they look at their daughters a little bit differently and think about them differently, I think, than if they had just had sons, because now you're talking about a daughter and what is your daughter going to do. So that has changed. But the other thing, I think, is about, if you boil it down to some of the core competencies that you need for leadership, both men and women need it. We might just look at it a little bit differently between men and women, and I think it's just based a little bit on that estrogen testosterone, and also based on the environment that you grew up in. You know, from your family environment, that will have an effect.
Well, you know, in many ways, I would agree with Claire's view that the world has changed so much that there isn't as many differences between men and women, and the skills that we bring to the table as leaders. Absolutely, I've seen a complete, maybe evolution, but almost revolution in that as well. I mean, in my career, you know, spanning just over 30 years, and also coming from agriculture, where often I was the only woman in the room, for sure, I've seen things change a lot. What I would say is that there are some natural tendencies, I think, for women that that they kind of bring to the table in a little different way than men leaders. But, you know, we're probably a little bit more natural at communication, perhaps. You know, we're a little bit, you know, we open up a little easier, perhaps, than men do, a little bit more quickly. So I think that's a bit of a natural tendency that we bring to the table. You know, I'm not saying that men don't have these skills, but I would say women tend to be a little bit more empathetic more naturally than men do, just because of, perhaps it's the estrogen-testosterone, you know, balance. But, you know, so as a result, we're a little bit more in tune with thoughts and feelings, and we're a little bit more intuitive, and we take it all in a little bit more easily. I'm sure you've all seen the joke, you know, on the internet about men's and women's brains, and you know, it's, you know, men, their brain is a bunch of boxes. They open a box, right now it's the sports box, and then they close the sports box, and then they open the work box, and then they close the work box, and they open the family box, and on it goes. Whereas women, their brains are just a big ball of wire, and everything's connected, and we see everything connected. And I mean, that sounds like a silly explanation of how we think, but I do tend to think that's a little bit about the difference between men and women. They tend to focus a little better, we tend to multitask a little better. We tend to take it all in a little bit easier. They tend to, you know, maybe cut to the chase a little bit more quickly. Now, these are all generalities, their tendencies. It doesn't mean it's for everyone, but I mean, that would be my general observation, is that we excel more easily in some areas than men do, but that's why you need to have diversity at a leadership table, because we each bring different things to the table, just the same way as our cultures bring different things to the table, our whether we've got a science background or a more liberal arts background, whether we have an accounting background versus a general, business background. So I think it is about diversity, but I guess I would see it's natural tendencies that would make us a little different. But I think the magic is in having it all at the table.
So I'm going to ask you a more personal question. Louise, have you faced yourself what you perceived as a gender bias around your leadership? For example, like I gave the story of the governor. Right? Have you ever, either insidious or blatantly?
When you're talking about that story, I was trying to think about myself, and I don't know, it may have been very subliminal, you'd have to catch it, but I don't know if I've really faced gender-based really outright. I think I've been in an environment that's been encouraging all along. There was one situation, it was more amusing than an actually outright it was when I was in agriculture. I was working with a bunch of guys. I was colleagues, they're all manager, and then I became their boss. And some of them, it was about a 20-year age difference where they were 20 years older than me. So I knew exactly how to manage them, which one needed more time. I call it more stroking, needed more attention. This one was more, cut to the chase. It was just rather amusing because I was now actually their boss versus their colleague. But they actually treated me really well. But I never had an outright saying, why are you here? You should, you have no right, or we didn't expect you to do this or that. So the answer is no.
Not plain. What about you, Alana? No.
I'd probably be, similar to Louise. I mean, having worked in agriculture, as I said, early in my career, I was often the only woman in the room, and I can't say that I was shut out of opportunities, that I was shut down. In fact, if anything, I sometimes viewed it as an advantage because I was kind of the one different person in the room, so actually my voice was heard almost above the rest and was gone to sort of more regularly than the rest because I was the kind of the one unique voice in the room. But I think it's fair to say, for example, I mean, the one time where I would say it was a bit of a challenge, I'm not going to say it stopped me from opportunities or I felt slighted or offended, but I knew there was a challenge as far as changing attitudes was I was elected to the board of AgriCorps United, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was a grain company that eventually merged with Viterra, which is now Glencore. But the company had been in existence for 100 years, and I was the first woman on the board in 100 years. And so it was a very unique kind of board situation. The governance situation, was sort of stuck in some old ways. And so it took a while for them to see a different opinion. But I have to say about half of the board, was really open to it, and the other half were slower coming around to it. But it's not that I was kept away from any opportunities or anything like that. But you could sense that kind of resistance. But I have to say my experience was similar to Louise's. It wasn't a hurdle for me, really. In fact, it was almost an advantage, or it gave me more opportunities as a result of being unique, certainly in the industry I was in.
Claire?
Yeah, I think my experience was probably the same. I don't think it really I don't think it really stopped me. I mean, there were certainly times early in my career as a young woman where I thought, gender differences were kind of the focus of a conversation that didn't need to be focused as part of that conversation. I recall one occurrence when it was still relatively early in my career, and I was having our children at the time, and I remember one of my male managers saying to me, if you want to be a leader, you're going to need to choose. And in hindsight, I often, and we'll maybe talk about mentoring a little bit later. This is the one area that I like to talk about with young women when they go there. is I think that was a tipping point for me in terms of my own security as a young professional woman and as a wife and as a mother, where I made a choice that I didn't need to choose. This was about what I wanted, and this wasn't about what he thought I should do. And of course, I chose my family over my career at that point in time, thinking, you know, no, I don't have to make the choice. You think I need to make a choice, and maybe that says something more about the fact that you're a man, but I don't need to. And that's the one thing that has always sort of stuck with me from a gender difference point of view, but I don't think it ever held me back.
So I want to move into the question. We've got about 5 more minutes. I want to talk, a young woman, your daughter, goes to Alana for advice, or my daughter, Taylor, goes to you for advice around, she aspires to be a leader in her career path. What advice would you give her, Claire?
I think the first thing that I would say is determine what's important to you, what you want, and then live by it. And don't be swayed by what other people think or tell you that you need to do. And I think that example for me in terms of, you know, you need to choose between being a mother and being a manager leader was sort of the tipping point for that. And so, and for me, our careers are very, very long. So I would say to any young woman, don't rush. Be very thoughtful about what you want, and don't give up things that are also important to you in life, because those are the things that you often can't get back. And yet you will have a very long and successful career. So I think that's the one piece of advice I would give. The second piece of advice I would give is be prepared to really work hard, to do everything that you expect other people to do. I think learning from that base and that foundation is critically important. And so don't expect anything of others that you aren't prepared to do by yourself. And if you work hard and you learn and you develop that confidence because you've worked hard and you learn, I think that holds you in really good stead for whatever you want to do. So I think for me, those are the two things that I probably really drive first and foremost.
Louise.
Claire raised a few good points, so I'll add to it, and I'll probably add two or three. One of the things that my career has been a bit of a snakes and ladders. I started off in the science area, got into on the social side, and seen both, and now I'm kind of in the middle because I dabble in the middle in post-secondary education. But I had opportunities to take positions to do different things that I wasn't too sure where it was going to go, but it was such a good opportunity that I said, just take it, you know, take calculated career and opportunity risks and put up your hand for sometimes the jobs or assignments you figure maybe no one else wants, but actually it gives you a lot of different skill sets, and you may develop some things that you never thought you could do by doing that. So take really good calculated career and opportunity risks when they come knocking, because sometimes they will only knock once. The other thing I would say is that what you do is important, because it is about reputation and how you deliver products, whether you do things on time, whether you produce a product or a report, whatever, that's good. That's important because, you know, you're building your reputation, whether you realize it or not, slowly, bit by bit over the years. And you get judged by what you do, not by what you say you will do. The last is, you know, you need to close, I call it closing the deal. Whatever you're going to commit to, whatever you're going to deliver, you got to deliver the product. Because if you don't deliver the product in the end, and it may be a great product, it may be a small thing, it may be a big thing, but it's really important to deliver that product. And as the other thing, as Claire said, you've got a long career. You're going to be working a long time. So you got to be careful. If you want to get to the top too fast, the drop sometimes is a little bit hard. So take your time.
Alana?
Well, all really great points. You know, I guess be open to all opportunities. Don't wait to be ready. You'll never be ready. I know certainly in my career I kept thinking I wasn't ready, I wasn't capable, and people would say, no, you are. And so with a great deal of trepidation, I would kind of walk through the door and find out, well, maybe actually I was more ready than I thought. I never really feel as if I'm actually ready, but you know, stretch yourself. Make sure you don't worry about always being ready. So I guess that's number one. Number two, you know, there's choices. You're not a victim. you get to decide. I mean, a little bit on Claire, you know, if you want to be a mom at that particular time in your career, that's good. Go for that and be okay with that. And you're not a victim that, poor me, I have to take maternity leave. That means I don't get a promotion. Yeah, but you've made a choice. That's when you've decided you're going to have children. So be okay with that. And I guess in those choices, know that, you know, you've got the long career ahead of you. So, you know, you can do all things. You can't do all things at the same time. So pick and choose and just pace yourself in your career. I know that's hard to think about when you're young, but from us old people, we're speaking with experience. You can do all things, just not exactly at the same time. And then in those choices you make, make sure you love what you do, because if you love what you do, you've got some hard days, but it doesn't feel nearly like the same amount of work if you're begrudgingly going to work every day, hating it and feeling like you're a victim. So in those choices, make sure you love what you do. Find your support system. If it's not your family, if they're not capable of it, find friends, you know, find something, but find your support system, and in that, make sure you're be kind to yourself, because we tend to beat ourselves up. You know, women were the best at guilt, probably better than anything. So be kind to yourself and make sure, you know, that that you find the support to lean on, and you're going to make mistakes. Don't beat yourself up.
Well, we're going to open the floor for discussion and open questions, but I just want to add a little bit. We have come a long way. I can remember with my last child, my fourth child, I had to go to work when she was 3 months old, and I wanted to nurse. And I can remember, it was at a university, nursing, pumping milk in the bathroom on the toilet, sitting there, and then putting the baby bottles in the fridge, and then at the end of the day, taking them home. And I was told that having the breast milk in the fridge in the staff room made the men uncomfortable, and so could I please not do that? So I couldn't store my breast milk in the fridge. So I continued to pump because it was really important to me, and I put them in mason jars in the fridge. Until the day I walked in when I saw a man pouring into his coffee. And I knew I was in trouble. So then we bought a cooler, and my husband would sneak in really, truly through the back door to pick up the milk out of the cooler, because a cooler didn't keep it as cold as a fridge, at lunch hour, and then I'd bring the milk home. So we've come a long way from that. I would hope there's no woman in here that's sitting in the bathroom crying, pumping breast milk, wondering where she's going to store it, right? But we still, I think, I'm always astounded at what we face. I can remember being on a panel with the president of SIAS at the time in the University of Saskatchewan, and they introduced both presidents, talked about the qualifications, their leadership, their accomplishments, and I was a third speaker. And they introduced me. They said, I want to introduce Brian Timmins. Doesn't really need an introduction. She's our little sweetheart. That was it. And I thought, well, that's not. And this happened in just not too long ago. And I'm astounded still that what still happens, what happens to my daughter, what happens to other women, the stories I hear. And so this is something that I think that's critical for us all to recognize, that the women in leadership bring diversity and value, but there's also, and I keep saying either unsaid or said perceptions that are still out there that undermine the accomplishments of women in leadership. So we have a question here. I'm going to give one, and then I'm going to ask the audience to question. What will it take to increase the number of women at the deputy level? And at the, I'm not going to say the president of the university, but at the deputy level, what will it take to increase the number of women? You're 6 out of 18? That's a third. It's 2015, and I think someone said that's why we should have equity. Alana, what will it take?
Well, I mean, I think we I don't know what actually the numbers are, but I know we have a tremendous number of assistant deputy ministers. Yeah, but ADMs, our ADMs, we have a large contingent of female ADMs. I actually don't know what the numbers are. Certainly at my management table, I'm now just over a third women. You know, obviously I would hope to get 50%. You know, I think what's it going to take? It's going to take more women choosing that as a career path. You know, at the end of the day, women make choices to put themselves into situations where they're making choices as to, you know, what balance they're trying to find in their lives. I mean, the reality is we, you know, we are the ones who are having kids. We are the ones that are deciding to maybe, I mean, I made a choice in my career and I stayed home for 8 years. I stepped out of my career and stepped back into my career. I think more women need to put themselves into those situations where they can be ready for those opportunities. Because I can tell you, in the government's case, it's not because we've decided that we don't want to have 50% women at the table of deputies. It's, you know, how ready are women? And are enough women out there who are choosing that as their career path? Because it's a very demanding job. And there are choices to be made. And as I said, you can't do all things all at the same time. So younger women are still raising families. And so, you know, I think it's about putting more women in the system who are willing to take on those challenges. I truly do believe that.
Okay, I'm going to give you the next question. When did you reach the point where you felt, I've made it?
I'm not sure what that means.
It must be a song.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can answer the question from the perspective of that I've made it from a career perspective or an aspiration or whatever it is. I mean, you know, I might actually go back and say it was when I became the chair of the Public Service Commission, which was sort of my first role as being a deputy minister. And it wasn't about aspiring to be a deputy minister or a deputy minister equivalent at that point. It was, that was the pinnacle job that I really wanted. I was passionate about the Public Service Commission. I was passionate about the role that it needed to play in terms of the workforce and the importance of the workforce in terms of being able to support government to achieve its goals. So when I got that job, that for me was just sort of that moment of, it was something I really wanted and I was able to achieve it. The deputies' roles that I've held since then, because in this job they just move you. You don't actually, you know, sort of if they want you here or there, they choose, the premier chooses to move you wherever. And each one of them has brought its skills and benefits that have just built on that, right? So it's all been good. Being a little bit more introspective though, I would say, I think I felt like I really made it, honestly, when I turned 50. And I don't know what it is about this decade, in my life anyways. I think it comes to a stage where the other things that are important in your life all start to take care of themselves, and you just feel a level of confidence and independence, and you stop worrying about all that other stuff that we all worry about, which is, you know, job security and your kids and everything else, that you are simply focused on doing the job, and that brings itself a whole set of freedom. So I'd say maybe when I turned 50, I felt like I've made it.
Okay. Louise, why is the public sector such an attractive profession for women?
Oh, I think so this is probably to do with the estrogen piece. I think what the public sector does do is that I think it's about working with people, it's about helping people, it's about encouraging people to get whatever they require, they need, doesn't matter if it's a service, doesn't matter if it's help in terms of family, health, or economic. The public service also is a great employer, and I think being a great employer, it's attractive, because if you need time to be away, take time off to be raising children, it allows that. The public sector, I think, also offers opportunities that's advantageous to move around. It's like one big corporation. You can do a variety of jobs in a variety of ways and still work for the same company. So I think the public service is attracted that way. And plus, I think it's just the innate nature that a number of women have of wanting to be of service, and wanting to improve lives and help others. So that's why it's attractive.
Great. An audience question. Yes, go ahead.
I have a question.
Introduce yourself.
I don't mean any disrespect to the answers that have been given, but I believe the stats say there's, you know, it's an unprecedented time where women are having children. So, you know, I have a lot of friends that haven't had families. Could you explain, you know, we often use the excuse that women aren't getting promoted because they've had families.
I can answer that.
But what about the women that don't have children? They're not getting promoted either. So I'm not sure that I see that.
Louise?
I'll answer that one because I don't have children.
And
oh, I need to repeat the question.
Oh, sorry.
Why don't you repeat the question?
So the I'll paraphrase it. So the question is thinking that all the panel members here have had children.
Did. I often hear that we don't see women being promoted because often they take time off to raise children.
Okay, so the question is you don't see women being promoted because of the time taking away to have children, but there's two women here that have had children. I probably misread your question.
That question was, what about the women who don't have children, so, are still not getting promoted?
Oh, it's still not. But you know what? It's whether you have children or not, it's based on your competencies in the end. It really is. It's based on what skill sets you have, what you can deliver, what you can accomplish, and also some of the training you had. Because, you know, I always say, you know, I didn't get to where I am just based on good looks. Though some people, I can say my husband may think I'm good looking, but that doesn't count. You're really based, it's based on the skills, what you've learned, what you bring to the table. That's what's going to get you promoted. It's also about relationships, whether you're a team player, whether you can work well with others. And the other factor is whether you have emotional intelligence. Because if you, you know, if you don't have any emotional intelligence, you can't read, understand what people are saying, what they're not saying, their body language, how to work around difficult situations, that will be an impediment to achieving whatever goals. You know, I have friends that haven't had children either, and it didn't matter whether they did or not. I think they got to where they were based on their competencies.
Yeah. Claire.
I want to chime in a little bit too, because I absolutely agree with what Louisa said, but I think the other piece for people to maybe think about is sometimes being promoted isn't about you and your skills. Sometimes it's about fit and the people within which you're working with. And sometimes there may not be a fit. You know, whether the leader and the person making the decision just isn't a good fit with you and the skills that you bring. That's all legitimate. That's just human interaction, and that's organizations, and that's just the way it is. So what I would say is, if you want to be promoted and you aren't because of that, leave. And I'm going to tell you that based on my own personal experience, because I was in an organization. I thought I had the skills. I wasn't promoted for a job that I thought I was qualified for. And no hard feelings. I mean, I just said, you know, thank you very much. This isn't the job for me. And I went and found another job. And I have excelled ever since. So, you know, don't be afraid to leave and go find someplace else that's a better fit and better appreciates the competencies you bring. And you know what? That next experience might be a whole lot different.
And I might just add that, I don't think it's about whether you have kids or not. It's about the choices you make and the kind of work-life balance you want to have and what you want to put into your career and what you're seeking out of your career. And it is about choices. I mean, if you're not getting the opportunities you want where you are, then look elsewhere. You know, I don't think it is about whether, sometimes you do have to step away from your career to have kids, but sometimes people step away from their career because they need to take care of an elderly parent, or they've decided to go on a life's, you know, trip because they imagine traveling for a year and discovering something. I mean, there's lots of choices that we make as people. So I don't think it's about whether that because we're having children. Obviously, we have a unique situation because we're the ones having children, but I don't think that's the key reason why we are or aren't being promoted. I think it is about finding the right opportunities and making the right choices for you, and I think in that, and having the competency and the knowledge and all of the skills that it takes to be in those leadership roles, and choosing that kind of work-life balance.
So Alana, this is somebody from the audience said, when we talk about making choices or balance, why are men not usually asked or think about these questions? It seems like men don't need to make choices.
I disagree. I think lots of, in particular, things have changed when I talk about, rather than evolution, revolution. I see a lot of young male leaders in certainly my ministry making choices about work-life balance much differently than they used to. The reality is as men become parents now, or as they take care of elderly parents, or as they choose to do other things to kind of, enrich their experience, they're choosing to step away, sort of similar to how women kind of have made those choices. In fact, in many cases, we're having, the man and the woman split their maternity paternity leave. because they are having to make those choices. They've decided that at this point their wife's career might need to take a certain path versus their career. Certainly in my married life, you know, my husband has decided to step away from his career, and he was the one that stayed home and mostly raised the kids, and I was the one that did different things in my career, which required a lot of international travel, and there was choices to be made there by him, and so his career didn't progress the same way as mine did, but that was a choice we made as a family, and so I don't think it's fair to say men don't have to make choices. I think they make the same choices now as we do. Yes, I think that's changed. I think women probably, you know, 20, 30 years ago, we were sort of, it was a given that we would be the one making the choices. I think now it's understood that we all make choices to have this better work-life balance. What's best for families? What's best for couples? What's best for kids? What's best for communities? What's best for organizations? I think men must feel some liberty in actually being able to make those choices, because it used to be if they did, well, then they were weak or unfocused or not committed to their career. I think it's much more fair now that we're all having to make those choices.
So another question. Thank you. Sheryl Sandberg has argued that it's not a jungle, that it is a jungle gym, not a ladder, why the classic path of career advancement is linear. What's been your experience? Is it a jungle gym or is it a ladder? Claire?
My experience is that it's a jungle gym. And, you know, going back to the question about, you know, when you're talking to people about their careers, and I think, I don't remember who said it, but take the lateral moves, right? Like move, take a chance, go elsewhere. That certainly was my experience. I mean, I certainly started out in the accounting world. I had a passion for HR, so I left the accounting world and made a move. People thought, like, why in the world would you do that? It was just really thought to be just, like, why did you invest all that time and then make that kind of a choice? That was good for me. I knew I needed some experience in a field that I didn't have experience in, so I actually took a lower level job so I could move horizontally to get that experience in order to enable me to then move up. And I made choices along the way in terms of where I wanted to move so that I could find the right balance, so that I could do all the things I wanted to do. And whether that was the volunteer work that I was involved in, or the work that I was doing, or my family life, it was about balancing all those things. So I think, you know, once again, I think it's do what's best for you.
So Louise, I have a question. Has there been a time in your career when you had no idea of the next step? And what did you steps did you take to get yourself back in the right direction?
There was a time. So I've had a jungle gym career. And I started off, I wanted to be a vet when I was 10 or 11, and that's why I got into the science. I didn't go into veterinary medicine, actually. I went into research. My background, animal science. I did a master's in reproduction in pigs and a doctorate reproduction nutrition in beef cattle. And I grew up in the city of Montreal. So it's a long story, and I won't do that. But when I spent so much hours in the lab, and when you work doing hormone analysis, you work in really minute amounts. When you're a cook, you know, you could add a little bit of salt, a little bit of this. You're working in the lab, you actually have to use precision because you're working with doing assays, and I needed to make sure that I wasn't providing any error in doing these results. But I did thousands of test tube work, so I needed to get experience. Got into working for government as a provincial swine specialist, wrote my thesis at night, got it done in half a year. And when I was writing my thesis, I knew I had to do something, I didn't want to do a postdoc, but getting into government, after about 2 years, I knew I needed a change. In some ways, I was a little bored, and I figured I had to think about a career path. So I went, I got an opportunity, I was in Saskatoon, got an opportunity to move to Regina to take a position working in livestock development. I did that for a year, and I knew it wasn't quite for me because it wasn't challenging enough. So I went and I talked to somebody who was secretary to cabinet at the time, and she was an old agriculture person, so there was a little bit of alumni. So this is about relationships, how it goes down. And she got me in, provided me with some conversations with people that I would never have had access to. And I did a number of informal, formal interviews, and that got me to work in exec council for 5.5 years. So once I did that, that got me on the path. But for the first part of it, I was feeling my way probably for the first 3 years. And then I started to lay out a plan.
Any other experiences, Alana?
Well, I mean, my career has been somewhat random. I'd like to say that I had a big plan and I knew what I was wanting to be when I grew up, and I didn't, and I definitely didn't have a path. So, I don't know if I've had a time in my career where I felt lost, but, you know, it wasn't an easy decision, an easy choice for me to step out of my career. When I mentioned, you know, I had kids and I actually was spending more money on a nanny than I was making in my career, I knew it was probably time to kind of go home and maybe raise my kids for a while. But I felt like, you know, I was never going to come back. I thought I was gone forever. And so I was probably lost a little bit that first year being at home. And then I find my way through it and I started doing consulting from home and kind of was back in the industry. So I think we'll all find a time in our career where we'll be a little bit lost, and I don't think we all have to have it all figured out either. I think sometimes people think, I know my daughters are in university and my daughter will be convocating in the spring, and you know, she's concerned, she's got to have it all figured out. What's she going to do and what's her first job and what's she going to accomplish in 5 years? And I'm like, relax, you'll figure it out. Wait for the doors to open and, you know, just start something. And you may not love it, but give it a try. Like, I think
I wish you'd been my mother.
Anyway, it's been random. But when I look back, there's probably been a bit more of a path to it than I realized. But
Claire?
I don't think so either, because I was sort of the same. I didn't really have a path. I mean, I just sort of took the opportunities and did what I thought at any point in time was sort of the right thing to do. You know, maybe in those early days it was sort of more defined, and I was very, I tend to be risk averse anyways, but I was very risk averse, I think, in the early times of my career. But then once I made the first change and realized that the change was actually good and it wasn't going to actually negatively affect me and I could actually handle it, then I think I was willing to then take a whole lot more opportunities for change. But that the first one, just because I think of sort of my comfort level in terms of being risk averse, was probably the hardest. And then after that, it was kind of easy going. So.
Well, I said that to you, Alana, because I can remember when I graduated with my education degree, I decided I was going to waitress and travel. And my mother, there were six of us in AU, she cried and said, if I wanted you to waitress, I would have supported you going to waitress school. And so I ended up going to Northern BC to teach the job, and I didn't travel, and I didn't waitress. And today, she says that now, that she wishes she had said, go waitress. But she didn't. And she can say that now, but it didn't help me then. So that's why I was laughing when you said that you tell your child to take their time. Question from the audience. Yes. Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Nathaniel Mayan.
Hi,
public admin, administration, intent for the Saskatchewan College of Mathematics. I'm from Johnson Chalmers for public schools. My question, before I say my question, I have to say my surprises when I came in. And I thought it was a public lecture, and when I saw the audience, I was like, okay, am I in the room where women are lecturing? And that wasn't the problem. So I'm now sitting in front. That is the typical male position.
Oh, no, I think James is right in the back there, too.
So my question is, I'm directing it to the three liberty ministers. Mostly there is accusation to women and other oppressed group that when one pave or break the barriers to that top position, they become blind of the opposition or the resistance or the oppression that they have undergone. And today we are talking of competencies, skills, and choices, all accounting to I made it and everybody else will make it. I would like to know from the perspective of the UT minister, whether that is a false accusation or it has some substances. I made it, everybody will make it.
So it's Nathaniel?
Nathaniel
asked the question, is when you get to a position of power or authority, sometimes you look back and you don't see the challenges you overcame to get there. And so he's wondering, for you as women, can we reflect back and say, because that's kind of what you presented, that that hard work you can get here, the, you know, choices you make. So he's challenging and saying, could this be true? Is it something that that he would like you to reflect on? Is that right, Nathaniel?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I'll get Louise to begin.
Sure, I'll answer that question. And, you know, I think when we talk about the competencies, what you need, I think we all have to, we all have a glass ceiling. You have to recognize your limitations, and you have to actually be honest with yourself. And it's a little bit what Lana talked about, you know, what are your values? One of the values is you know, be honest. I mean, I'm not going to be an astronaut. I'm scared of heights, but I'm not, you know, there's some things that you're not going to do. Not everybody's going to be a deputy minister. Not everybody's going to be an ADM. Not everyone's going to be an executive director. But you have to recognize what you're passionate about and what you're good at, and accept that in some ways, and also decide you're going to be the best that you can be. But I, part of your question also deals is, you know, do we expect everybody to? Are we blind to some of the challenges that we face? No, I mean I'm not blind. I mean, in that. Whatever you're going to choose or wherever you're going to go, you actually have to be willing to work hard and put in the time and effort, no matter what it is. And we talked today that you have to be willing to do it. And Alana talked about also not having, you can have it all, but you can't have it all at once. I mean, I don't think, we're not the first deputy ministers for government. There's been others before us who have, you know, paved the road, so to speak, but they, you know, they wouldn't have given any more chances to women than they would have men. We try to give the same chance to everybody for the opportunities based on whether they have the skill sets, whether they're the right fit for the job they have. So I'll leave with that. I don't, you know, I try to think, you know, of all the experiences I've had, you know, some have been good, some have been harder, some have been easier, but it, you know, I've sort of survived in many ways. So I don't know if I answered all of your question the way you were asking for it.
Claire, we'll go on and see all three.
I think it's a really good question, and I think it's an important question, and maybe one of the really important reasons why we're here today is to have that conversation, because you're right, once you get to a place and life feels more comfortable and you know you have that level of confidence, I think you can lose track of maybe how hard it was. And that's probably a good thing in many ways, right? Because that's what actually gives you a sense of freedom to actually keep going, right? Is that people are resilient and they're strong and you forget all the bad stuff and you think about all the good and what you're able to do. But your point is well taken that we should never forget and become complacent that it's easy for everybody else. And I'd say that's important for everything that we do. And, you know, I reflect on actually even the way in which I work with my kids in terms of the struggles that they're having with now as young adults and young professionals and having come through school is that, you know, when I think back and, you know, I thought, oh, I couldn't remember how hard it was in university and I had to work really hard to appreciate how hard they were having to work and how difficult that was. And now when you mention that, I probably need to be more sensitive and attuned to the fact that as I'm working with my colleagues to always think back and to reflect and to think about, you know, just because this is relatively easy for me now because of where I am in my life and my career, it probably isn't as easy. If I put myself back in those shoes at that point in time, I need to be more understanding. So your point is well taken and I thank you for making it because it probably will help me actually do a better job. So,
Alana?
Yeah, I mean, both Louise and Claire have made some really great comments. I think that the only thing I'd add is, you know, the reflections that I've shared on my career have been my experience. You know, I'm not saying that's been everyone's experience. You know, my perception would be that we are open to providing opportunities to women in leadership roles. That certainly is, you know, a stated goal of the government of Saskatchewan. I think we're, you know, an equal opportunity employer. I think we seek to have diversity Are we exactly where we need to be? No. Is it a work in progress? Yes. Have we made some progress? Yes. Is there more to be made? Yes. So, I mean, the fact, and I mean, I don't want to, you know, sort of gloss over the fact that there, everybody has challenges in their careers and their lives. Probably everybody's got some variability in that. This has been my experience that I'm sharing today, but I'm not saying that's everyone's or that everything's come easy, because it certainly hasn't. There's lots of challenges that we all have, but I mean, as Claire said, I mean, it's important for all of us, you know, because I don't know if we've all made it. I wouldn't put it that way, but you know, where we are in our careers, it's probably important for us to reflect back and think about what some of those challenges were, and it's a valid point. These are our experiences and our perspectives now, but we do need to be aware of the fact that it isn't always just easy sledding for everybody.
So there's a question: that can a non-Canadian become a deputy minister?
Actually, I don't know if technically. I don't even know technically. I think the key to being a deputy minister would be that you're legally entitled to work in Canada. That would be sort of my gut reaction. I can't think of anything that would preclude that. But
okay, I will mention that approximately 46 of ADMs are women. The question.
46%.
Yes.
Oh. Yeah.
So and then I will. I'm going to end with just two questions left. This person wrote, early in my career, I was not promoted. The reason I was told was that the position report to a man who didn't work well with women. So I respectfully disagree that gender differences don't matter. What advice would you have given to my younger self?
Alana. Leave the organization and go find a place where you're welcome and will be promoted.
Okay. Claire?
Don't be a victim.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. That was exactly the experience that I was sharing with you. I mean, I aspired to a promotional opportunity, and the man that was the hiring manager, I don't know that it was that he didn't want to work with women. My gut tells me that was the fact. He certainly didn't tell me that. So I left.
No, I agree.
So this is the last question, and then we'll do a bit of a wrap-up. What is the one thing you would still like a need to accomplish as a leader? Mm-hmm. Alana, what do you still want to accomplish?
Well, you know, I guess to just always grow and always recognize that we don't have it all figured out. Remember to listen and you know, remember to be more self-aware. Like I think it's just constant improvement, knowing that you actually have never really made it, you've never really arrived, that it is about continuous improvement and constant learning and growing and expanding how you see people and you know, increasing your knowledge. I think it's just kind of more of everything.
Okay, Claire.
Yeah, the first thing that came to mind was I want to be better. That's it.
Better.
Yeah, I just want to be a better leader.
Yeah. Okay, Louise.
What I would say probably, well, two things. One is keep on learning till I take that last dying breath, because I think continual learning more about yourself, about others, how things work is constant, whether you're retired or not. And the last thing would probably be is probably making, you know, the work we do, I think about it from the post-secondary side, and Bianne can think about it, she'll relate to this, is that, you know, the importance of education. And when you think about, for somebody who is the first person in their family to get a degree and to graduate, the opportunities, the doors that it opens for this individual, for their kids, for their grandkids, is just phenomenal. So for myself, it's really about having the ability to change one more life.
Thank you. So I'm going to ask you to do a favor for the panelists. I'm going to ask five of you to stand up and tell me one thing you want to take away today. I'm going to repeat it into the mic so that our Saskatoon people hear it. So five people. So one thing, just one thing you're going to take away today, if you could stand and just say it.
Don't be a victim, be proactive in the choices that you make.
Great.
Be authentic and follow your passion. Great.
Yeah, love what you do, and that we always have a choice.
Love what you do, and we always have a choice. Pardon me?
Be determined
in your work. One more.
Continuous improvement.
So this was a great discussion, and I will tell you some takeaways that I want to take away. One is the humility that these women have shown, the genuine humility. You heard them say that they achieve leadership positions because of hard work, being prepared. And that is about humility, right? They also talked about the importance of diversity in decision-making and in an organization's health, and important to do what you want to do and to love what you do. And those are all things that are critical. So I think these panelists are great examples of distinguished leaders who mentor others and who are inspiration to all of us today. And I want to just thank you for your comments and your work and the perspectives you've shared. I reflected throughout this conversation a lot, and I think everyone here has. Can we give them a big hand?
Just to wrap everything up, a lot of comments were reiterated. I certainly appreciated Alana's "you can have it all, but not at once." But that's, to take that to another conclusion, I'd say it's also important to understand that you don't have to do everything in order to do something. And you know, you can do no more, but don't do any less. So to those of us who joined us in Regina and Saskatoon and online, I'd like to thank you all for recognizing why this is important and why this matters. Thank you for your questions, and thank you for taking the time to ask and to listen. For those at Johnson Shoyama who helped coordinate this event, thank you. And finally, to our moderator and panelists, Dr. Vianne Timmons, Claire Eisman, Louise Greenberg, and Alana Cook, we look forward to seeing more great things from you in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.